We are continuing in our study on the church gathered together. I want to say that we have now been in this series for 5 weeks. We'll be in one more week next week. We'll wrap it up, and then we're going to start in the book of Colossians. And so I encourage you, if you want to, read ahead in the book of Colossians and get that well under your belt, so to speak, so you got it all together. But we're going to continue for today and next week on this topic of your church together. And today we're going to talk about the idea of struggling to gather. The motivation for this series began as I was grieving over the fact that after months of not being able to gather as a church in person, I think it was 3 months or so, or four, or it felt like forever, I had really thought and I had really hoped that when we got to come together, that people would just be clamoring to be together, that we would be almost overrun. Maybe I was a pipe dream, but that's what I thought. What I found, rather, was that it wasn't so. Now, I really enjoyed, and I have been enjoying, those who have gathered together. To see your faces Sunday after Sunday, for many of you, is a delight and an encouragement to be. But I was also despairing over the fact that people didn't return. And I'm still struggling to reconcile why those who could gather are choosing to not do so. So I've described it as a crisis. And I know that's a strong word. In a day and age where people are throwing around all kinds of very strong words, maybe it is too strong. But when we think about our circumstances and dilemmas that we're under, I don't think it is too severe. I don't think it is severe enough if we consider that God gave us Christ, and Christ died on the cross for our sins. I don't think it's too severe when many consider gathering once or twice a month to be what they call active involvement. I don't think it's severe enough when gathering together takes a back seat to sleeping in or brunch plans or a work project or going to the beach or our kids' activities. I don't think it's severe enough when a person who understands what the Bible teaches about the essential nature of gathering, the priority of being together, and how our trust should be in God, and yet they say, "I won't come." I don't think it is severe enough when people forsake the command to gather. I don't think it's severe enough when I watch helplessly as people are falling into depression and increased anxiety, when isolation and loneliness is growing, when habits of prayer and reading the Word are increasingly being neglected, when our video services, for instance, aren't being watched. I don't think it is severe enough when I hear that people are questioning if the Bible's call to love each other really means the church, or it might just mean something else, or that they think that a Zoom meeting is as good as meeting together. We are in a crisis. Now, this crisis did not start with COVID. All that COVID did was illuminate it, and maybe in some respects is increased it. So we're struggling. And I believe that many of us are fighting through. That your struggle is a struggle in which you are winning. That you're fighting for what is right and what is good. But I think there is others who are like they are on a battlefield, and they're in the trenches, and they're bleeding, and they're wounded. Some are being willfully disobedient. Others are being kept in the chains of their circumstances. So today we want to talk about struggling to gather. We are finding it hard to be the church together, and we need to fight for us being together. So I want to look at this by answering the question that is posed by Gunnar Gunderson. In that little book that I referred to earlier in the series, you may not have been here to see that, but it's just a little green book. We made copies available, and the title of the whole book is, "What If I Don't Feel Like Going to Church?" So we're going to look at that question, what if I don't feel like going to church? And I think to begin, we have to clarify that the question really is not about feelings. Feelings are these internal perceptions that may be seen as emotional reactions. So if I have sadness, if my feeling is sadness, I may express it with tears. If my feeling is joy or happiness, I may express that with laughter or a sigh of contentment or a smile. So we need to understand that we must remember that our feelings are not the measure of truth or reality. Our feelings are not the measure of truth or reality. Proverbs 14, 12 and 13 says, "There is a way that seems right to a man." That's what it is. When we feel something, that feels right to us. But he says also, "But its end is the way to death. Even in laughter, the heart may ache, and the end of joy may be grief." So our reality, our truth, cannot be measured by how we feel. Then we must also understand that feelings should not make our decisions, but our decisions should be made by our Christian values. By our Christian values. Galatians 6, verse 9 says, "And let us not grow weary of doing good." Isn't that how we sometimes feel? We sometimes feel weary. We sometimes feel tired. But we shouldn't be ruled by our feelings. It says, instead, do good. Do not give up doing it. For in due season, we will reap if we do not give up. And then our feelings are merely indicators of underlying conditions or circumstances. They are not primarily the problem, usually. They are simply a symptom of them. It says in Proverbs 20, verse 5 and 6, "The purpose in a man's heart is like deep water." And what he's saying is that the real reasons, the real purposes behind things are deep down. They're buried in us. They're not the things that usually bubble to the surface. Those things are just the reactions to them. But he goes on, "But a man of understanding will draw it out. Many a man proclaims his steadfast love, his own steadfast love, but a faithful man who can find." And then I would also say this. We need to understand that making decisions by feelings is the pattern of this world. It is worldly to do what we want, when we want, how we want it, simply by how we feel about something. What we should be led by is by the Spirit of God. So we see two different sides. In Philippians 3:19, we see that their end is destruction. Their God is their belly. So I'm feeling hungry, so I will eat. I'm feeling this, so I will do this. That's what it's saying. And it goes on, "And they glory in their shame with minds set on earthly things." But the contrary is Galatians chapter 5, 22 to 24. "But the fruit of the Spirit is love, joy, peace, patience, kindness, goodness, faithfulness, gentleness, and self-control. Against such things there is no law. And those who belong to Christ Jesus have crucified the flesh." In other words, their God is not their belly. They've crucified the flesh with its passions and desires. I like how John Piper explains it. He says this, "My feelings are not God. God is God. My feelings do not define truth. God's word defines truth. My feelings are echoes and responses to what my mind perceives. And sometimes, many times, my feelings are out of sync with the truth. When that happens, and it happens every day in some measure, I try not to bend the truth to justify my imperfect feelings, but rather I plead with God, purify my perceptions of your truth and transform my feelings so that they are in sync with the truth." So how do we maybe understand this practically? Maybe I'll just give an illustration. I have a great deal of love and affection, and I adore my girls. I would go to the ends of the earth to try to help them if I could. But what if one of them came to me one day? And often how they come to me when they want something or they want to kind of get me to do something, they say, Daddy, but let's say in this time, one of them says, "Daddy, I'm in love with a woman and we are getting married. Will you support me? My feelings of love for my children would be mixed with a broken heart. A part of me would desire to support her, but truth would have to prevail. The Bible is clear on such matters. And with tears, I would have to tell my child that I loved her and I would pray for her, but I could not support her." We have to do what is true and is right, not just what we feel. What Gunderson is pointing out is he's talking about the struggle that we have with our desires. Really, if we were to reword the question, it probably would be better suited to say, what if I do not desire to go to church? And when we talk about our desires, there is also some things that we need to understand. We need to understand that we normally have a mixed amount of feelings, a mixed amount of desires. There's desires that are competing with one another. I can, on one hand, desire to stay in bed when the alarm goes off. Anyone else have that issue sometimes? The alarm goes off and just 5 more minutes, snooze. 5 more minutes, snooze. You know, and you just keep doing that until it's like, oh, it's like I just started at 7, now it's 9 o'clock. You know, it's like we just keep putting things off. We have these desires. So on one hand, you may have the desire to just stay in bed, turn the alarm off. While at the other time, you desire to go to work because you need to earn money so you put food on your table. So we have these mixed and competing desires. We should also understand that when a desire leads us to make a decision, I want to do this, I desire to this, so I shall do this. It reflects the dominant desire at that moment. So when I decide that I'm going to go to work rather than stay in bed, or if you're going to stay in bed rather than go to work and you've got to call in, make some excuse, I'm sick, sorry, I can't come in, whatever you have to do, right, or think you should do, you have given in to the greater of your desires. That is the dominant desire at that moment. When I go to work, rather than stay in bed, it's motivated by the greater desire to serve the church, to earn a living, all these different things. We have a number of things that motivate us. But our desire leads us to make a decision, and it reflects the dominant desire at that moment. Then I would also say that our desires are always influenced. Our desires are never free. They are decisions that are decided by those factors. So what influences my desire to go to work? Well, one thing it might be is I have a sense of duty. I said I would do it. I made a promise to do it, so I go. That could be one reason. Another is I might be full of pride. I don't want anyone to accuse me of being lazy, and so I'm going to go to work. It might be the fulfillment and joy that I gain from my work. Perhaps it is because, you know what, I really enjoy going to work. I enjoy going to work more than I enjoy sleeping in, so I'm going to go to work. It might be that appointment that I promised I would be at, and I can't, and I don't want to leave the person sitting at the restaurant all by themselves, so I better go. It might be the deadline that I have for a sermon, because if I don't have something, then I'll look pretty foolish up here and nothing to say. And you might be surprised at that. I do have times when I have nothing to say. And so I need to prepare. But hopefully, at least in my circumstance, and yours as well, that we hope that in that action of getting ourselves up, getting dressed, getting ready to go to work, that we are glorifying Christ, glorifying God, and we're showing that we are caring about what He's provided for us. In my case, it's the love for the church. Paul expresses a clear desire of his in Philippians 1:8 when he says that he yearns for the church. Or when he says in Romans 1:11, He longs to see the church in Rome. Or in 2 Timothy 1 verse 4, where he says, again, he longs to be with Timothy. And so why did he not go to see these churches? Well, it's either because he had a greater desire for doing something else. He was called to spread the gospel over here, so he couldn't be over there. And God led him in that direction. Or it was because he was often imprisoned. He was restrained. For Paul, he literally was behind bars and behind chains that restrained him. So I think that this brings up a legitimate question. What do we do about those times where it seems we can't? Is there not times when we could say, you know what, I just am not able to gather with God's people? And I think the answer is yes. For Paul, it was because he's behind chains, or he's in chains and he's behind bars. He cannot go. I think there are legitimate times. But we need to be cautious, because as human beings that deal with sin, we are susceptible to rationalizing to the point that choices of will not start to become cannots. We make them into something. Well, I just cannot do that. Well, how many times when we say we can't, it's really that we won't. Our hearts, as Jeremiah 17:9 says, are deceitful above all things. If I can convince myself that, for instance, eating a giant Costco chocolate chip muffin. Have you ever had one of those? They're huge. They're like this big, right? And if I can convince myself that one of those muffins is healthy for me and not just a big chunk of chocolate cake, or if I can convince myself that eating a whole box of Oreo cookies is bad for me, but eating one of those bags of Oreo minis is good for me, if I can convince myself of that, I can convince myself out of gathering with the church. I can. So when considering our desires, it is important to consider that God commands us to be self-controlled. These two things go hand in hand. It's important, as we need to recognize that if we are left to ourselves, if we are left without the working of the Holy Spirit in our hearts, what we're simply going to do is whatever our desires dictate. In Ephesians 2:3, he is talking about what it was like and how it is like for those who are unbelievers, and how what it is like for those who once were unbelievers. And he is saying, this is how you once were, among whom we all once lived in the passions of our flesh, carrying out the desires of the body and the mind. They were doing whatever their passions led them to do. They were doing whatever their desires led them to do. And they were therefore children of wrath. He says, we were like that, like the rest of mankind. I know, and you probably do too, what it is to give into your desires of what you want. There was a time many years ago where I was 100 pounds heavier than I am now. And how did I get there? I gave into my desires. I simply said, you know what, I'm going to eat what I want, when I want, and how much I want. And I rationalized it all. We also need to remember that the calling of the Christian is to restrain desire. It's called self-control. As was already read for us, in 2 Peter, I'll just read a portion of that in 2 Peter 1, 5 to 9. It says this, for this very reason, make every effort to supplement your faith with virtue, and virtue with knowledge, and knowledge with self-control, and self-control with steadfastness, and steadfastness with godliness, and godliness with brotherly affection, and brotherly affection with love. For if these qualities are yours and are increasing, They keep you from being ineffective or unfruitful in the knowledge of our Lord Jesus Christ. For whoever lacks these qualities is so nearsighted that he is blind, having forgotten that he was cleansed from his former sins. So Peter puts it well when he says that lacking self-control is a kind of nearsighted blindness to the fact that we have been cleansed from our sins by Jesus Christ, and we need to walk in self-control because the Spirit is within us. Think about it as the decisions of your day. If you or I did exactly what we wanted at any one moment, just think about that. If you did what you desired to do at any one moment, if our eyes were fixed on what is immediately before us, it would be terrible. This week, if I just did whatever felt good, I would have said something unkind to someone. I would have looked at something impure. I probably would have eaten too much at a meal. And that was probably just Monday. We also need to remember to ask ourselves, where does our inclination, where does our desire to act out our base desires, to rationalize them, come from? Why do we do that? Well, we are motivated as people without Christ, without the work of the Spirit in us. What happens is we're motivated by our selfishness. We want our way, when we want it, and how we want it. And when selfishness takes root in our desires, it will lead us to give all kinds of reasons, all kinds of excuses, all kinds of rationalizations to make our desires good. Mike Dooley writes from a very secular perspective, very ungodly perspective, when he says this, and I don't think this is an unusual way of thinking. He says, "You simply cannot give to the world all that you have to give to the world if you do not remain true to your own selfish desires. You have a unique set of precious values that can only be fulfilled by pursuing what drives you the most, your passions and dreams. Always, the masses benefit from the individuals who insist on marching to the beat of their own drummer." He's basically saying, you know what? Your best way of helping people in society is to be as selfish as you can. That is very anti-biblical, by the way, if you hadn't guessed. I think we also need to remember, when we allow our selfishness to let our desires run free, what we're doing in giving in to our desires is we're trying to find our joy. We're trying to find our fulfillment. We're saying, if I do this, this will give me the maximum amount of satisfaction possible that I can think of at this moment. We have convinced ourselves that we will only be happy when we can do exactly what we want. And that's always the message of the world to us. You will be happy if you hook up with that girl. You're going to be happy if you eat that entire pizza by yourself. No one gets any part of it. You are happy if you give that person a piece of your mind, because they certainly deserved it. You'll be happy if you can buy that car or purchase that TV or that pair of shoes or whatever it might be. You might be happy, you know what, if I could just have that place outside the city near the lake, that would really do it. Or if I could visit this place, or if I could be married, or if I could be unmarried. People give all kinds of reasons. But as Christians, we need to see that this is a deadly road. I thought about it this week, that if Jesus had gratified his desires, he would have turned stones to bread, he would have thrown himself off the temple, he would have worshipped Satan, and he never would have gone to the cross. And we would never have read Hebrews 12, verse 2, that says, "Looking to Jesus, the founder and perfecter of our faith, who, for the joy that was set before him endured the cross, despised the shame, and is seated at the right hand of the throne of God. I was talking with someone this past week who described a struggle with desires that I think I understand and probably you do as well. He described his struggle to come to a church activity. And he had gotten home from work and he was tired and he wanted to just rest and it would have been just easier to watch a program on television or head to bed early or do whatever. But everything seemed to be better at the moment than getting up, getting back into your car, driving to church, and being with God's people. But he said to himself, no, I need to follow God. He was led by the Holy Spirit. He picked himself up and went, and he gathered with God's people. And after, his reaction is the same as I have experienced so many times, and I've talked with many of you, and you've experienced as well, is at the end, even after we've had that struggle and that fight, we say, you know what, I am so glad I went. I am so glad I did that. It was so edifying. It was so good for me. And why do we struggle with that? Why is it that Gunnar Gunderson says the most important time to come to church is when you don't feel like it? That is the most important time to come to church, to be part of God's family, to gather together. See, what is happening is when we struggle with our desires, we are fighting a war for our hearts. When you struggle and you wrestle with yourself, should I go or shouldn't I go? You are in a war. Satan and our sin are encouraging, and not even that, they are demanding that we be selfish and that we gratify ourselves. And if our sin and Satan does not want us to gather together, then what we need to do is we need to rebel. We need to rebel because their intentions, their desire is to keep us from our Christian joy. When we are suffering, when we have failing health, when we're struggling with our sin, when we're depressed or anxious, or we have relational strife, that is when it is more important than ever to gather together. The very place, it seems at one hand so odd to me, that the very place that offers and brings healing to our hearts and our minds is the very first place people say they can't come to when they're struggling. And I think I know the exact reason why. I'm going to sound awfully arrogant and definitive right at this moment. Satan and your sin wants to keep you from the comfort and the care and the correction and the truth and the reconciliation that is found when you gather together as God's people. That is what they want. So in the minutes that we have together left, let's take some time to diagnose our hearts. Let's do a little examination by looking at the reasons that we don't gather. First of all, there are physical reasons. There are times when we have the flu, or someone is under cancer treatment, or they're confined to a hospital bed, or they're dealing with some kind of chronic pain or headaches. Some physical conditions will keep us from gathering, but we need to be careful that we do not rationalize. There is people here right now, and if you're dealing with the same things that you were dealing with last week when I talked with you, you're still here. You're dealing with them, and you're still coming. You didn't rationalize, but you might have, or you could have. I'm not feeling particularly well today. Maybe I'll just stay home. We go to church, whether it's with a headache or a broken leg, or if we're just tired because we stayed up too late the night before. We then have spiritual reasons. And this may be the root of many or most reasons we don't feel like going to church. When we are giving into sin, when we are giving into worldly priorities, what we're going to do is we're going to rationalize Christian activities right out of our life. We're going to hear people saying, you know what? I can be a good Christian without the church. They're going to come up with all kinds of things. They're going to rule them. Because when you go to church, you know what's going to happen? If the church is doing what it's supposed to, it's going to confront those sins. And that's going to be painful, and you're not going to like it. No one ever does. But as they're confronted, God brings healing, and He brings resolve, and it will free us in the long run. And then we come up with rational reasons, or relational reasons, sorry. So it might be that you're having a marital problem. You know, if we go to church, if I go to church by myself, then how's it going to look? Or if we go together, are we just being hypocrites and all these different things? And you're struggling. Or maybe you come to church and go, you know what? I really don't have very many friends. I don't know a lot of people. I just feel disconnected from the church. Maybe you're alone. You're a single person, a widowed, or you're struggling with another person at church. There are times when you go, you know what? I don't get along with this person in church. So maybe I should just not go. The resolution of these things is not going to be solved by staying away from the church. Because if the church is functioning as it should, and I'm not saying that we always do, but I sure hope we're moving closer to it, is that the church is the place that these things are solved. You're having a marital problem, there's people in the church that want to help you to solve that. If you're having a singleness problem, well, I don't know if we could solve that one, but you know, a friendship problem, yes, we want to be friends together. These things are solved when we're together. Then there's logistical reasons. It could be how far you live away from church, or the hours you work, or maybe it's just getting your family ready in the morning is hard, or the homework that you have. Maybe it's all piling up and you have an exam next week, or whatever it might be, and you're struggling. Or it might be just a project you have at home that you feel pressured to get done. Some of this, frankly, is just excuses. We have people from this church that drive 40 minutes from outside the city to come, and they are regular in attending. We have people who work the night shift and they stay up a little longer and they come to church. We have large families that battle like everyone else to get all their kids ready and yet they come. And when it comes to your homework, as one who has done a lot of homework and has children who do homework, more times than not, it's a stewardship of your time. You chose to watch a movie instead of doing your homework. Or you have a home project. Your home project can wait. It will not fall behind. It will not suffer because you come to church. Then there are preferential reasons. And this is probably a bigger issue than we really realize. You know what? I don't feel comfortable coming to church because the music is too loud. Or the music is too soft. It's just not right. Maybe, you know what, the church has a certain leadership structure. I don't know if I'm comfortable with that leadership style, so I'm just not going to come. Or maybe the sermon length, it's too short or too long. I know your biggest problem is that it's too short. I get that. And you know, I'll work on that, I promise. But, you know, we have these issues. Or you know what, they serve us coffee when we could serve coffee, and it's just not good coffee. We have these reasons that we give. You know what probably is one of the most prominent things that I deal with when it comes to conflicts in the church? It's over preferences. I want it my way. And this is nitpicking and an excuse. Then there might be cultural reasons. Now, in our church, we're a culturally diverse church. But there can be ways in which we sometimes feel, and maybe this falls under it, is that we have churches where there are people who are very poor, and there are people that are very rich, or that it's a church where predominantly everyone is more wealthy, and then if you have a poor person, they feel uncomfortable, they feel like they don't fit in, or sometimes there's language issues, well, I don't quite understand things. You know that on a Sunday morning, I just want to put this out to you, that if you send me an email, I will send you the notes for my sermon before Sunday, so that you can read them and you can get a better handle on what I'm going to try to say. I will do that for you, and I'm doing that for other people. And so there's ways over these. There might be cultural differences, language issues, all these different things. But the one thing we need to remember is that this diversity that we have is absolutely fantastic. The Bible makes it very clear that the one thing that brings us together and the only thing that needs to bring us together is the gospel. We believe in Jesus Christ together. And it doesn't matter whether you're economically different, socially different, culturally different, that does not matter. We celebrate those parts. And if, for instance, in the book of Philemon, there's it's a short little book about a slave and a slave owner. And if Paul can instruct them and say, you know what, as a slave owner, treat your slave like a brother, and they can overcome those differences, we can overcome ours. Then there might be recreational reasons. We might say, you know what, my week is so busy. I get to work early, I'm there late, then in the evening, I got to put the kids to bed, do different things, I got to catch up on this or whatever it might be. So my weekends are the only time that I have free. They're my time to run errands. It's a great time for me to participate in my hobbies if I want to do any travel or leisure or my kids' sports. All these things happen on the weekend, so I don't have time to go to church. We treat these times, we treat this moment as a precious commodity. And I would say this, is there a good reason to say they are more important than gathering together with God's family? Can we honestly say that? Then there might be doctrinal reasons. We might struggle with differing beliefs. I have talked with many, many of you, almost all of you, about some of the things you believe, and they're not all the same. There's differences. But that's not an excuse. Now, there are moments where you could be in a church where they are teaching error, serious error, like Jesus is not God error, or things like that. Well, that is a bigger issue and certainly needs to be addressed with a great deal of concern. But often what it is that simply, I'm not comfortable there because the church doesn't emphasize the things I want or doesn't align itself with my convictions. If it's a gross doctrinal error, like we're talking heresy, well, I can understand. I'm not going to attend a church that doesn't believe Jesus Christ is God. I would tell you to all leave right now if we believe that way. But I probably wouldn't because I would believe that way, and then so I wouldn't say it. But anyway, you get the point. But other than that, if we're dedicated to scriptural truth, our personal beliefs, our secondary beliefs, our emphasis, our bent is not a good reason to step away. And then there's intellectual reasons. This could be that the teaching in the church, whether that's in Sunday school classes or from the pulpit as I preach to you, that they are too simple or too complicated. Now I get that. There can be occasions where what I try to do when I'm preaching is I'm trying to nail some kind of point in the middle. That's what I'm trying to do. And I'm not saying I always do it well, but I'm certainly trying to do that. And if you think that the content of the teaching in the church is too simple, then if you would go to one of the pastors and you would say, I want to learn more. First of all, the pastor will then have to pick himself up off the floor because he's not used to hearing it, but he will then rejoice and want to help you to grow. And if you want to have more doctrine, more theology, something more complicated, something more serious, I can certainly help you with that. I love that. Or if you think it's too complicated, we can help you with that too. You go to someone and say, you know what, I'm not getting it. It's just straight over my head. I'm not understanding a bit of what you're saying. Well, then we put you together with a mentor. Richard Salas is working with a number of people. We're putting people together for one-on-one discipleship, and we help you to grow so that in time you start to understand some of these things. But we don't walk away. We don't stay away. Then there can be transitional reasons. You know, maybe someone's moving to a new city. Well, the solution to that is move to that city. Find a good church and stay and participate and be together. Maybe the church is getting a new pastor, right? We're not in that situation, but churches go through that. They sometimes stay away because you go, you know what? He's not like the old one. He's not ever going to be like the old one. Ever. In fact, he might be better in some ways or worse in others. But he's going to be different. Or maybe my friends are moving away from the church. This might be a shock to some of you, but just because your friends move away from the church doesn't mean you have to stop being friends with them. You know, you don't have to do that. You probably all just presume that, but I see it happening. Well, I really don't have time for you anymore because you don't go to church with me. I've seen it happen. Maybe a baby is born. And in cases like that, have your baby. We'll rejoice with you, celebrate with you, get better, get well, get strength so you can come back to church. But I would really encourage you to not allow your child to dictate your schedule. You can train your child to work around gathering with the church. And then there can be things like personal reasons, personal hurts, such as a church division or a scandal that happens in the church or a split in the church. All of these things have made the church really hard to love. And my answer to that, without going in it for hours on end, is to say this. We need to remember something. That the church is filled with sinful people. I am a sinner, and so are you. And there are going to be times when you are going to say or do things that will disappoint each other and disappoint me. And there will be times when I will do something or say something that will disappoint you. But just because we go through those things doesn't mean that we need to then fall apart. There is sometimes church division. There are scandals. This church has faced scandals. But the cure for that, the way to overcome it and to learn from it and to grow through it is not to separate ourselves, but to come together. If we are suffering, we need to suffer together. Throw a hand around someone. Give them a hug. Listen to their plea. You can't do that if you're apart. We have to come together if we want to be healed. So a general rule to help us think through these things, these different reasons, if our reasons would not keep us from doing the things we love, they should not keep us from gathering because the things of God should be what we love first. To illustrate that just briefly, when I was in college, I loved playing intramural sports. I played intramural basketball and floor hockey and I think almost everything except soccer. I don't know why, but I didn't. Anyway, so I played all these intramural sports. And there was one occasion in which I had to go and drive to Nipawin, Saskatchewan to bring a friend to school. And it was the middle of the, I don't know why, it was the beginning of the semester. I can't remember all the details. But anyway, I had to drive all the way out there, so you know how young people do. Let's just do it straight there and straight back. So we jumped in the car at like 4 in the afternoon or something, drove the entire way, got into a hotel and slept like 2 hours and then drove all the way back. And then, do you know what I did that day when I got back? I barely got back in time, is I went and played intramural floor hockey because that was important to me. But you know what, at that time in my life, if it had been church that morning and I got back, I would have said, I'm too tired. I'm just going to sleep in. And I demonstrated at that moment that what I loved was intramural sports more than being with God's people. Sounds horrible, doesn't it? If our reasons will not keep us from doing what we love, then it should not keep us from gathering, because God should be what we love first. If you can't go to work, you can't get out of bed, if you can't take your kids to practice or make your way to the car, you don't have enough energy to make a meal or even get dressed, I'm going to be the very first person to say to you, stay home, get rest, get better. But I want you to be alert for hypocrisy. If I can go shopping, what does it mean if I would say that I'm too tired to go to church? I'm too busy for church, but I can run around every evening of the week running errands and doing my kids' activities. I can send my kids to the what we might call the petri dish called school, but it's not safe to go to church. I can serve in the church, or I can't serve in the church, but I can build a deck at the lake. Doesn't make any sense. I can learn a new skill, something new at my job, but I'm unable to learn the Bible. Something wrong. And you know what? I get it. I have my days when I would just love to sleep in. This morning, the alarm went off, and I was just awake enough to think, okay, what day of the week is it? Oh, it's Sunday. Right, okay. I just want to stay in bed. I have that. I go through that. And you probably do too. Maybe not just Sunday, but other days as well. And we have all kinds of things in our life. Not just that, not just sleeping in. Maybe I'm just, why is he focusing just on sleeping in? I don't know, maybe that's my problem. But I get it. We have days when we are tired. We have days when we just don't want to do something. It feels easier to just stay home. I get it. But don't some of them sound just absolutely crazy if we'd actually speak them out loud? They do to me. Tom Rainier, on his website, asked people to submit the most outlandish, true reasons that people gave for not coming to church, not gathering. And so I just want to share a few of them with you. They are bad, so just be warned. Number one, not in order of rank. Like he said, it's not like this is the worst ever. But here he says, one reason that someone gave for not attending the church, we were out of peanut butter. I'm not sure how worship and peanut butter are connected, but if they are, I just encourage you to keep a lot of peanut butter at home. Apparently it improves your spiritual life. Another one, I was too drunk, so I went soul winning with my dog Rambo. I don't get that at all, but that's what someone said. Both of my girlfriends attend church there. I think you have some deeper problems if that's the case. That is the person that needs to be pulled aside and said, you know what? From a married man to a single guy, you can only ever handle one woman. You should maybe start that now. So, but that apparently was a true excuse. Another one, the worship leader pulls up his pants too often. It's distracting. I don't know, what can you do with worship leaders? They are something else, right? So, who knew? Another one, my kid takes naps during that time. And I would say, great, bring them, and then they can sleep right beside all the other people who are sleeping during church. You can just be together. It'll be great. You can have a little sleep in, you know, and all sleep on the floor together. It'll be wonderful. I think you should do that. This one I've never experienced personally. The pastor is too attractive. When I see him preaching, I have impure thoughts and I am distracted. That's never been said about me. If you feel that way about me, please don't tell me. I do not want to hear it. It would not be good. My wife cooked bacon for breakfast and our entire family smelt like bacon. I just want to let you know on the record that if you come to church smelling like bacon, that is great. We should bottle that and we just should all spray ourselves down with it because it would be the only fragrance we allowed. Bacon is wonderful. Another reason that they gave, or someone gave, the pastor stays in the Bible too much. I'm just going to move on. The church is too close to drive and too far to walk. So I have the perfect solution for you. Either pack everything you own and either move closer or further away to make it easier on yourself. Yeah, buy a bike. Yeah, yes, yes. Yes, I believe Steve and Carol have a couple that they could let you try. Yes. Yeah, yeah. And this one, I debated whether I was going to put in there, but I thought that this must be a bigger issue than I really realize, and so I need to share it so that we all can work through this problem. One of the reasons given was I was too constipated. I don't know if that's a Sunday-only problem, but apparently it might be a problem. So I am sure that none of us would have such outlandish excuses or reasons as these, would we? But how would our reasons sound? How would our reasons sound if we had to stand before Christ and he would tell him, well, I just couldn't gather? I imagine Christ, knowing our hearts as he does, saying possibly with tears, I died for those people. I did not make excuses. I did not say I was too busy. I didn't say it was too much pain or too much suffering. When we are dealing with our desire, we should make every effort, not every excuse. Let us pray.